You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the latest news on the war in Ukraine and the aid being sent to Ukraine from Western countries as European leaders announced today their support of the country joining the European Union. Now, do you ever come home after a long day and not really feel like making, you know, a full-on dinner, entree plus sides? Sometimes you want to just grab some favorite snacks and have an informal meal, maybe with some sweet and salty, crunchy and chewy. It's Food Friday, and our guest today says that is just fine. He encourages it. He wrote a whole book on how to do it even better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite snack you like to eat for dinner? Do you like having that dinner of a bunch of little stuff instead of that big thing and then some side dishes along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lucas Vulgar is a writer and editor. His new cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner. Small bites, full plates, can't lose. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'll say up front, I am so on board with this. I do this sort of snacks for dinner sometimes, and I'm like, why don't I do this more often? Then I forget about it. So your book's a new inspiration. What was your inspiration? There was one particular meal that got you on this theme.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'd probably, it's kind of an intuitive way to eat, but there's this one meal that sort of calcified it in my mind. I was traveling, it was in Los Angeles, I visited a family friend. She had invited me over for lunch. This is something that had been planned a ways in advance. And when we got there, there were sort of like no signs of any meal preparation happening, which, you know, I'm kind of a planner, and so that always worries me and stresses me out. But then over a matter of like 5 or 10 minutes, she just kind of pulled together this beautiful meal. She had picked up these dips from her farmer's market. She had these really delicious carrots. She threw out a wedge of cheese, a bowl of crackers, and it was all these like little things that were out on the table. And it just ended up becoming this incredibly memorable meal for myself and my husband, Vincent. And then as the pandemic wore on, it became a very functional way to eat because we didn't want to wash any dishes. Tortilla chip became a spoon. The tub of hummus became a serving bowl. We sort of like ate with our hands as much as we could because we were so tired of washing dishes. And so that's sort of where the book journey took me. And now I just find it to be an incredibly fun way to entertain with my friends and just putting all the food out on the table. And it's so functional for people with dietary restrictions. You can get vegetables in there in so many different ways. It's just been, it doesn't have to be this sort of sad, passive way to eat. That you can do it with intention. You can do it with a lot of fun flavors and great seasonal produce as well.
And I love this style of cooking because I sometimes think, oh, if I'm doing it this way, I need 5 or 6 different things. So that means I have to make 5 or 6 different things. But as you just pointed out, there can be a hybrid. The dip you bought at the market or local store or whatever, maybe something you prepared yourself that day, maybe something you made the night before. You can really do a lot of different workflow here.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that was kind of important to make clear when I was writing the book is, no, this does not mean that you have to make 7, 8 different little, you know, things and then serve little, you know, portions of them, but instead you can sort of mix and match. And I think that something that makes a snacks for dinner meal really shine is when you can source sort of carefully. So like, I love visiting farmers markets whenever I travel, and I find constantly that, you know, while certainly this is one of the best places to get good produce, it's also an incredible place to find locally made cheeses. There's like a wonderful like Lebanese purveyor at my farmers market where you can get these incredible little salads, breads, crackers. If you could just pick up a few things from that or a specialty store in your neighborhood, you're going to have some really, really nice food, and you won't have to make all of it yourself.
Lucas Vulgar is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday. His newest cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to eat this way? Do you like to entertain this way? A bunch of little stuff instead of that big fancy centerpiece in the meal. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lucas, you have kind of a philosophy of putting these things together, and you divide the cookbook this way of having, you know, different kinds of dishes like crispy and crunchy or tangy and juicy. Can you run us through those categories and why you like to have that contrast?
Sure. The way I thought to organize this book was primarily by trait, thinking that if you can satisfy these textural components, then it's going to sort of like naturally it naturally becomes sort of like a really nicely balanced and varied meal. And so my first chapter in the book is Crispy Crunchy, and that's little like snack mixes and those types of things that, you know, you might even think of them as a garnish and a traditional meal, but it can be so much fun to have a little bowl of Chex Mix or even like a sort of thoughtfully and interestingly seasoned bowl of popcorn at the table. And then there's Tangy Juicy, and those end up being like pickles and like marinated vegetables, which just bring a pop of color and brings a, you know, sort of a hit of sweetness and acid. And the nice thing about these things too is that they allow you to sort of like customize your bite. So the crunchy things can be sprinkled over a little bit of soup, and the pickles can, you can garnish a little like, you know, dip on a cracker with a little pickle. There's also in there, I have a whole section of, you know, crackers and breads, and I call that sturdy supports because you're going to need something to carry that dip. And then I also put in a chapter of soups and salads, and the way that I sort of fashion those as being snack friendly is the salads, I call them spoon salads. And the thinking behind them is that the vegetables are either sort of like finely shaved or grated, and then the salads are very like nutritionally dense. So one salad I'm thinking of in particular is a carrot, lentil, and date salad that's then flavored with a bunch of fresh dill. And so just a few spoonfuls of this, it delivers a bunch of flavor. And then also it's just, as I said, it's really nutritionally dense. So a small amount goes a long way on the snacks plate.
You shared a few recipes with us, including that lentils, carrots, and dates with dill salad. That is up at WPR.org/Food Friday for anyone who wants to check it out this weekend. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I have a little sister who is a grandma extraordinaire, and when her kids were little, her grandchildren were little, she would give each of them a skewer, you know, like for at supper time. And she would have all kinds of stuff, really good, you know, fruits and vegetables and cheeses. And, you know, she could even have a couple of hot dogs in there. It didn't, you know, didn't matter. And said, you can only eat what you can skewer. And the kids would have a ball. And they ate so well. You know, the parents would say, oh, no, they'll never eat that stuff. They'll never eat that kind of thing. And they did. And they ate everything. And they didn't know it, but they ended up loving that kind of food, and they still eat like that. Yeah, I mean, not necessarily with the skewer, but they eat, you know, healthy food.
Now, wait a minute, Susie. Were you jealous of the skewers? Did you have to get a skewer, too?
I was very jealous because I only heard about it. It was just when she was with her grandkids.
Susie, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. A really little presentation thing there. Lucas made a lot of difference and got kids to eat stuff they wouldn't eat ordinarily.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea for the skewers. I definitely want to try that out. I mean, one of the things I wanted to mention is one of the sort of fixtures of my snacky dinners is a big plate of crudité. And I like to actually spend some time on it, you know, cutting the vegetables into the, like, you know, shapes that are going to be really friendly for like scooping up a dip or, you know, so. And I guess just what I'm trying to say is like putting some intention into those vegetables and getting really fresh, delicious ones. And when I do this and when I'm eating like with my nieces and with my friends' kids, they are so excited to eat the vegetables when they look really cool. So I'm actually not surprised that those kids were, you know, the whole skewer meal went over well with them, because that's kind of been my experience with this as well.
Thanks, Susie, for that call at 800-642-1234. You just mentioned dips, which can be a great part of these meals. Store-bought or made at home. You shared a recipe with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday, a toasted walnut and feta dip. You call it the perfect excuse to eat a whole block of cheese in one sitting. We don't have any problem doing that in Wisconsin, I'll tell you. But tell us about this toasted walnut and feta dip.
Sure. This is a very simple dip. It's you're going to toast a good handful of walnuts, and I like to toast them quite well. That brings out as much of the flavor as possible. And then it's simply blended with feta cheese. I think it's important to use a brine feta that comes in the brine, because that's going to be more moist and creamy. But if you don't have that, I've got some workarounds there where you can just add a little bit of milk. But the walnuts and the feta go into your food processor and it's blended until it's creamy. And then I make a little garnish with some leftover toasted walnuts and that goes on top. But really, that's it. It's all of my dips. I try to make them as simple as possible because I think it's kind of fun to just whip up a dip if you have friends coming over and it only takes a couple minutes.
We're talking to writer and editor Lucas Vulgar about his new cookbook. It's called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite snack you like to make and eat as a snack or make it part of your meal? Do you like eating like this? I love it. Hey, you know what? It just hits me. This reminds me of something we got here in Wisconsin at the supper club. My favorite thing at the supper club, the relish tray. Do you have a favorite relish tray, a favorite thing to have on it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Now we pick up our Food Friday talk with Lucas Vulgar. He's the author of the new cookbook, Snacks for Dinner. Small bites, full plates, can't lose. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dip, a go-to recipe to share? What is the best food to dip in your dips? I hope you don't double dip. Do you like to make meals, as I do, out of little things, a bunch of little stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sue is with us in Fish Creek. Sue, hi.
Hi, what a fun show. One of our favorite things is left overnight, but it's not left overnight from one night. It's left overnight from three or four nights, so that you have a little bit of everything. And I'm really interested in reading your guest's book so I can do extra little things to tie all that together.
Oh, interesting, Sue. Thanks a lot. Yeah, if we want to theme our leftovers into our snack meal, Lucas, any thoughts?
Yeah, I love that you bring that up, Sue, because one of the things that appeals to me about this is how resourceful this style of eating is. I find with leftovers, if you only have a little bit of something left over, it's hard, you know, you can just kind of eat it there at the fridge and make it go away. But if in a snacks for dinner spread, that small amount of leftovers can actually go a long way because everybody only needs a little bit.
Excellent, Sue. Hope that helps. Thanks for joining us at 800-642-1234. We've checked out a couple recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's one more sriracha snack mix with puffed rice and peanuts. Now, I hear the sriracha folks are having some supply trouble with some key peppers, but assuming we can get our hands on sriracha or something like it, tell us about this kind of zippy snack mix.
Yes, for sure. And you can use other types of sriracha, which are available here. I know that there's a bunch of different alternatives at the grocery store, which would work great in this dip. But anyway, this is another very simple recipe. You're going to toast some puffed rice or any kind of puffed grain that you like with some almonds and peanuts. It's a little bit spicy mix. It dries out really nicely so that it's really crispy and crunchy. It would be a beautiful thing to use as a garnish on some kind of soup or throw into some kind of salad. But to be honest, it never really lasts that long for me. I find it completely impossible to stop eating just as a snack mix.
Now, how about you mentioned you've got a chapter that includes some soups in it, which I don't always think of as part of a snacky meal. I don't know. What kind of soups fit well in this kind of combo?
Yeah, I like that you brought that up. I was I had thought the same thing at the outset as well. And then one of the things that struck me as I was working on this book was how, I mean, I have a smoothie habit. So I make a smoothie almost every morning and drink that. And I take it with me on the go. And I'm like, a smoothie is really just kind of like a sweet or a savory kind of cold soup. And like eating it on the go sort of in my mind refashions it a little bit as a snack. And so I kind of went in that direction. And so they aren't all cold soups. But they are, you know, the way a smoothie is sort of like has this concentrated amount of flavor, sort of similar to what I was saying about the salads before. Like the idea is that the soup is pretty intensely flavored and a small amount goes a long way. So I've got one soup in there that's a really delicious spinach soup that you saute some fennel down. So it has this wonderful sort of floral black note back note. There's another, my favorite gazpacho recipe. It's a watermelon and tomato gazpacho that when everything is really ripe and juicy, that's the time to make this. And I'm really excited because we're starting to come upon that season right now. And what else? I think there might be one or two other soups in there, but they're well flavored so that you can serve them just in a small cup or a small bowl and add them to your snacks table.
We are having snacks for dinner on this week's edition of Food Friday. Lucas Vulgar is with us. His new cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can sample some of what he has to offer at WPR.org/Food Friday. He's shared three recipes for us. That snack mix we just talked about, a walnut and feta dip, and a lentil, carrot, and date with dill salad. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite snacky dinner ideas. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James writes there, I've been known to enjoy crackers and Laughing Cow cheese spread wedges for supper on occasion. Yet something as simple as crackers and spreadable cheese can be a great part of a snacky dinner or maybe a dinner all by themselves. Do you have favorite combos, Lucas?
I love that. We have the Laughing Cow cheese in our fridge as well. I mean, I think with cheese, what's kind of fun is like how easy it is to have a couple of them on hand. And, you know, you don't need to eat all... I know you can throw that whole block of feta into your dip, but you can sort of throw out a couple that complement each other. And it's a really easy way, especially for a vegetarian meal, to get a little bit more, some protein on the table and a little bit more creamy textures and stuff. So that meal that kicked this all off, there was a big wedge of like a dill flecked Havarte cheese, which I don't buy that often, but it just tasted so good in this meal. And we just cut off slabs and added them to our salad and with our crackers and stuff. But I also love, there's a recipe in there where you can take goat cheese or feta cheese and then just marinate it quickly in some olive oil and some fresh or dried herbs and spices and chilies. And that's a pretty easy way to sort of transform a roll of cheese or a wedge of cheese into something that is very different and then keeps well and just gets even more and more flavored over time in the fridge.
I want to key in on one chapter here where if you want kind of a highlight of a snacky meal, you've got a centerpiece-ish section. What can ascend a snack to that centerpiece quality?
Sure. I wanted to put this in here. The book is not really organized around the style of eating where you have this sort of like main dish or this protein in the center of the plate and then a couple sides around it. The idea is that everything kind of has their small bites and they all have equal billing. But these I think of as a little bit more centerpiece-ish because like when you put them out on the table, they might anchor the meal a little bit. So one of my favorite things in there, there's a feta and jam tart. And this is a feta based filling. And then you sort of spoon your favorite tart jam over the top of the filling and then swirl it into the batter. So it's a really beautiful, really striking centerpiece type dish, but it's also very, very rich and flavorful. So sort of in keeping with those salads and the soups, a little bit of it goes a long way. And it's really easy to also eat out of hand.
One thing I wanted to ask you for my own personal edification, you mentioned spoon salads. I'm a big fan of making slaw. And when I'm doing something like this, I'll often do a carrot slaw and maybe a cabbage, you know, a basic coleslaw. And I've experimented with some things like celeriac slaw, which is the only food my kids actually spit out of their mouths when I made it. So I never did that again. But do you have ideas on other good vegetables that work for the slawification process?
Yeah, well, I think one of the vegetables that I think is a little bit underrated, and I know if your kids don't like the celeriac or celery root, this might be a little bit of a challenge, but I love kohlrabi. And if anybody belongs to a CSA, they've probably gotten a kohlrabi in there and maybe they weren't sure what to do with it, but it's a, kind of like a cross between like a turnip and maybe a potato. So it's like milder in flavor, but you can grate that or shave it really thinly and then toss it with, any kind of dressing you would use on a slaw. And it would function in a really similar way. I also think that celery can be used in this way if you shave it really thinly. And then you could sort of go in a mayo-based dressing direction, but a nice sort of really acidic and bright vinaigrette complements that really well too.
All right. Now, a logistical question I've got for you. If we're entertaining for a group of X people, you know, if we're doing an entree, you know, I want to buy about, you know, this many pounds of protein, whatever it is, for this many people. How do you figure out how much of the different things to make to make sure you've got the right amount of food and not, you know, overdo it?
I kind of think my rough formula is like for 2 to 3 people, you want like 3 to 4 items. I think if you're going to go all in and say it's a dinner party or say you're having 8 people over, kind of the more the better, and really don't hesitate to like lean into the store-bought, you know, option there. Just spend some time sourcing it, but and save your time in the kitchen, but then also invest in those. You know, it can be really fun to like make. I have a recipe for focaccia in there, like a big platter of like fresh made cut up focaccia is just like such an inviting thing. And then you can buy the dips, or you can go to the farmer's market and get a couple of the salads, and they'll function and they're really, really well. But I think if you're wanting to impress, I would just try to get a lot of food on the table. It's really dazzling and it's really exciting. And the fun thing about entertaining too is that you can set it out before anybody arrives, and you know, right then when they walk in and it's, and you know, and they're invited over to the house, there's all this like fun food out on the table and just kind of gets everybody really excited.
In just our last few moments, we've got a lovely weekend coming up in most of Wisconsin, then some 90 something degree days. Do you have a favorite hot weather combo?
Well, that gazpacho I mentioned is definitely one of my favorite hot weather foods because it's so quenching. But, you know, the other thing is just I really enjoy these crudités when these vegetables are in season and you can spend a minute just like, you know, cleaning them nicely and cutting them into fun shapes. In the book, I have a whole sort of tutorial on how to prep your crudités to make them really arresting visually. Some really cold, fresh vegetables and a couple dips, like nothing really beats that, to be honest.
Lucas, thanks so much for joining us today.
But thank you so much, Rob.
That's Lucas Volker, a writer and editor. He was with us sharing his new cookbook on this edition of Food Friday. The cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can find a few recipes that Lucas shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got a salad, we've got a dip, and then we've got a snack mix. Check them out at WPR.org/Food Friday. Maybe make them over the weekend. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the Wisconsin Election Commission is at the center of complaints about the 2020 election and in the midst of getting ready for the 2022 midterms. The new chair of that commission, just appointed to that commission, joins the show. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever had cats, you might have given them some catnip and then seen them freak out, roll around in it, chew on it, generally have a good old time with the stuff. Looks like fun, and there may be an evolutionary reason for it. Mosquitoes. As reported on the Smithsonian website, researchers in Japan tested catnip and a related plant with cats and found it has some natural mosquito repellent chemicals in it. It repels mosquitoes a little bit when cats roll around in it, but when they chew it and lick it first, it damages the leaves, releases more of those chemicals in a more effective cocktail. So your classic cat freakout chewing and licking catnip then rolling around on it can be a decent mosquito repellent for cats. Now, how about us humans? Researchers say chemicals from catnip could be worth a try, but not if you're allergic to cats, because you're going to attract them while you repel the mosquitoes. Something to chew on. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. European leaders from France, Germany, Italy, and Romania announced today their support of Ukraine joining the European Union. This comes as Russia enters the fifth month of its invasion of Ukraine and takes more control of the eastern Donbas region. Western countries, including the U.S., continue providing military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine in support of the country. But Ukrainian officials worry that support may go down as the war goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want this story to stay front and center here in the U.S. media? Do you want to see continued U.S. support for Ukraine? What questions do you have about what's happening there and what the future might hold? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He specializes in international security, including topics like armed conflict, foreign policy, and political violence. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you talk about how the nature of the war has changed? It seemed like Russia hoped to win a quick and total victory in the earliest days, and now it seems to be this grinding attrition war with lots of artillery. What is it? What do things look like now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a good capsule summary. In the opening days, they wanted to attack the major cities in the north, the capital of Kyiv and Kharkiv, the second biggest city, with these lightning strikes, and they hoped the government would fall very quickly. They would take those cities and basically from there take over the whole country without having to do much fighting. But those initial attacks were defeated, and they withdrew from those positions, and they circled around and started attacking from the east. And that eastern region is where they already had some presence because they'd been supporting these so-called separatist republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. And so they came in through there and started attacking to the northeast and the southeast, linking up with their forces coming north from Crimea. And the front lines have really basically stabilized ever since, with the exception that inch by inch, bit by bit, the Russians have been making progress in that far eastern region, in the Donetsk-Luhansk area. And so we see them taking one town after another, but paying a heavy cost and inflicting a lot of damage as they go. But that's essentially where we are in the conflict.
Big picture, I want to look at war aims, what different sides want, and what that means about what an end of the war would look like. First of all, we had Vladimir Putin on the birthday, the anniversary of the birthday of Peter the Great of Russia, making a very direct comparison, saying Peter the Great, well, he didn't conquer territory. He took back Russian lands, and that's what we're doing in Ukraine. Does this give us a sense of what Putin hopes to get out of this invasion?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting and revelatory remark. There's been a lot of debate about what Russian war aims were. The more pro-Russian side saying, well, Russia felt threatened by NATO and potential membership of Ukraine in NATO. And so this is a defensive reaction in response to that threat posed by NATO and NATO expansion. And the more skeptical anti-Russian perspective saying, no, the Russians are imperialist or, you know, hearkening after their lost empire, however you want to characterize it. And Putin wrote an interesting memo a year ago, basically laying out that second position that Ukraine didn't really exist as a separate state and ought to be reunited with Russia. But a lot of people dismissed that because, of course, a lot of the Russian statements were about NATO and NATO enlargement. But this most recent set of statements is about as direct as you can get in saying, yeah, you know, we want to be just like Peter the Great and the Tsars of Russia. We want to expand and take territory. It's really our territory to begin with, so we're just taking things back that we rightfully have, et cetera. So drawing a direct line between himself and the Tsarist Empire of the past, which a lot of people thought he was very sad to see disappear at the end of the Soviet Union and wants to reconstitute today. So that motivation seems to be quite strong there.
From the perspective of Western supporters of Ukraine, the U.S. And Western European countries who've been sending arms, there's a lot of talk and a lot of rumors about what leaders of different countries are hoping for from Ukraine. Some saying, we want to see Russia completely driven out of Ukraine, saying, well, that's going to take a long time. Maybe Ukraine should concede some of this territory. What are you watching for in that, I think, behind the scenes debate?
Yeah, I think it's mostly behind the scenes, although it comes out in public every now and then. The big debate is, well, there's, of course, the debate of, for the Ukrainians themselves, what their aims are in this war. And that's going to depend a lot on what they're able to accomplish. They would ideally like to get all of their territory back. They'd probably even like to get Crimea back, although that's a very tall order since they lost that in 2014 and the population wasn't especially anti-Russian to begin with. But they would certainly want to get back all the territory they've lost since February of this year, and probably also like to get back the rest of Donetsk and Luhansk that were supported by the Russians in these separatist regions. But then the question is, how much should the West continue to support the Ukrainians in their efforts to achieve those goals, or should we try to pressure the Ukrainians to accept less than that, indeed to make peace on terms which would involve substantial territorial losses since the beginning of the year, or even just recognize the military status quo on the ground at some point. I think the more, the less supportive countries like Germany, for instance, and even France to some extent, have been talking about the need to not humiliate Putin, which implies that Russia should get some gains out of this war. And the more sort of resolute, I would say, countries like Great Britain in this case, have been saying, no, we should support them as far as they want to go. I think a natural focal point is going to be the status quo of February of 2014, before this war started. If the Ukrainians were able to get that back, I think that would be a lesson that, you know, aggression doesn't pay, and a great success for Ukraine. So I think the main debate now is between, should we support Ukraine to try to achieve that goal if they can achieve it with our support, or should we pressure them to settle for something less, essentially that grants Putin some concessions?
We're talking to Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security, with us for a look at the latest updates on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the military and humanitarian aid recently sent by the United States. More on the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of U.S. support for Ukraine? Do you want to see more of it or less of it? What is your answer to the question our guest just posed? Should Ukraine give up some of the territory that Russia invaded to put an end to this war or not? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your comments, or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security, talking about the war in Ukraine and Russia's attempts to take control of the eastern Donbas region and ongoing Western support for Ukraine. Still time for your call with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see this issue kind of slipping from the radar in the United States? Do you worry about that, as some Ukrainian leaders do, that support might dwindle for the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On the subject of U.S. support, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke with other countries talking about their support for Ukraine after the U.S. announced it's giving $1 billion more in aid. Here's part of his speech.
We've built tremendous momentum for donations and delivery of military assistance. And after this afternoon's discussions, we're not just going to maintain that momentum, we're going to move even faster and push even harder. We'll deepen our coordination and cooperation, and we'll bolster Ukraine's armed forces to help them repel Russian aggression now and in the future.
Andrew, what kind of support is the U.S. giving along with allies, and is it the right kind of support from the Ukrainian perspective?
The kind of support they're giving is military aid, first and foremost, artillery, ammunition, which is crucial in these eastern battles, which are, as we mentioned before, turning into these artillery duels, these battles of attrition. Also, long-range rocket launchers, usable in the same sort of situation. But also, interestingly, coastal defense military assistance, in particular, Harpoon missile launchers. The Harpoons are these missiles capable of taking out ships at sea. And the Ukrainians have just quite recently taken advantage of earlier ones that they've been delivered to attack a Russian naval seagoing tug off the coast of Snake Island, which was so prominent in the early days of the invasion. And that's a huge deal because right now, traditionally, the Ukrainian wheat and grain supplies are exported through the Black Sea to the rest of the world, which really needs those supplies. And the Russians have been blockading the Black Sea and preventing the Ukrainians from exporting from having shipping in the Black Sea. So if the Ukrainians could free that up, that would be a major development. So having those coastal defense forces is important. There's also a humanitarian component. I believe there's generators, medical supplies, water purification, and things like that. But those are the major items. And I think that's exactly what the Ukrainians need. The question is it enough? How much? The Ukrainians, of course, will always want more. And indeed, to really turn the tide of these battles and start going over on the offensive, they might need quite a bit more, because these artillery battles are extremely resource intensive and use up a lot of material.
Andrew, some Ukrainian officials have expressed concern that their Western supporters may be feeling some kind of Ukraine fatigue, as the media maybe isn't covering the story as much as other issues, maybe domestic issues, get more high profile. They worry that people are losing interest. That could lead to support drying up. And I'll say, you know, a month or two ago, we were getting lots of calls on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, none at 800-642-1234 if people want to prove me wrong. But is there that concern that that kind of interest fatigue could lead to a decline in support for Ukraine?
There's a concern about that, although I think it's inevitable and has to be budgeted for that. This is going to be one issue among many. It's not always going to be the only thing that gets reported and talked about. And indeed, it shouldn't be. There's plenty of other important things going on. There's the economic stories in the United States, inflation, the Federal Reserve. There's the January 6th hearings. So there's other things that are important that need to be, covered intensely. And there haven't been startling new developments on the Ukrainian situation either, having entered this sort of war of attrition, mostly static phase. So I think that's understandable. The question is, will support dry up? And they're hard to say. I mean, hopefully not, from my point of view anyway. I think we should continue to support the Ukrainians in their struggle to preserve their independence from Russia. I think the fundamentals are still sound, and you see some great signs of long-term support. I think one of the most important ones is the European Union moving, the European Union Commission in particular, moving towards placing Ukraine on a path towards membership in the European Union. This is a huge deal. Remember, if we go back to 2014, the whole reason for the Euromaidan, the protests that happened back then, was that Russia, essentially Putin, basically forbade the Ukrainians from signing a trade deal with the European Union, which he thought would place them on that path towards membership. So Russia has objected towards NATO enlargement, towards Ukrainian membership in NATO, but they've also objected towards Ukraine's membership in the EU. And if Ukraine gets in the EU, that will, I think, give it institutional ties to the rest of the European countries and will help solidify that long-term support. And also, interestingly, in terms of how Russia has scaled back its ambitions in the course of this war, not only have Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership, which was unthinkable before this war happened, but the Ukraine now is on this path towards membership in the EU. And Putin today said that he didn't have a problem with that, essentially trying to make, put a bold face on a brave face on something that he can't control anyway. So the end result of this, even if the Ukrainians lose territory, is that Ukraine will end up as a member of the European Union, which is something that Russia was desperately attempting to prevent from happening. So I think that bodes well.
I want to jump in and bring on a caller before we run out of time, Andrew. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hello.
Yeah, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I think not only should we equal what we're sending to Ukraine right now, I think we should triple it. I think it's a great opportunity for the United States of America to show that we still stand up for what's right. It's not going to hurt any of us. It's, because the people that manufacture the weapons are going to make a ton of money. But it's still a chance that we can show that we do have some backbone left in this great country.
Pat, thanks for the call. Briefly, Andrew, how much can the U.S. escalate support without maybe getting some kind of response we don't want from Putin?
I think we can go a bit more than we have. Everyone fears, of course, the most extreme reaction, which would be nuclear escalation from Putin. And occasionally he makes remarks about that. But I have not seen a really serious nuclear threat out of Russia yet in this entire crisis, I would say. And I see very little reason to expect one, provided that we don't engage in direct war with Russia, right? If we were flying airstrikes against Russia, bombing Russian territory, that's another matter. We're not going to do that. I think we can support the Ukrainians, and if we can give the Ukrainians the tools and they can get the job done, I don't think Russia is really going to respond with nuclear weapons.
Pat, thanks for the call. And Andrew, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at possible outcomes of the Russian invasion of Ukraine as the U.S. and other Western countries continue to provide military support to Ukrainian troops. Now, a Minneapolis man pulled over in Wisconsin says police took nearly $10,000 from him, even though he was never charged with a crime. His case is an example of the burden that can fall on those who have cash, vehicles, or property seized by police. In spite of a 2018 law intended to limit police ability to seize assets from people who aren't convicted of crimes, it still happens, Rich Kramer reports.
Clifford Skinner's mom died in March. He wanted to help his father pay for the funeral, so he says he took $9,600 when he and his family drove from Minneapolis to Gary, Indiana. It was almost all the money he had, but Skinner says his father wouldn't take it. On the way home, Skinner was sleeping in the car when a Wisconsin State Trooper pulled his daughter over for speeding near Osseo.
He approached me and said that he smelled marijuana coming from the vehicle. I informed the state trooper that I am a medicinal cannabis user and my doctor prescribed me that as medication.
Skinner says the trooper took less than a quarter ounce of marijuana and seized all of the money. He received municipal citations but was never charged with a crime. Still, the state patrol wouldn't give Skinner's money back. The agency told WPR it wouldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. Skinner, who is black, says his money was referred to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency on suspicion it was tied to drug trafficking. He denies that.
Guilty until proven innocent. And that's basically where I'm sitting at right now. An innocent man that got robbed by the police and been unjustly done because of my skin complexion.
Skinner's fiance, Trina Lewis, says they were saving the money for a down payment on a future house. She wasn't there during the traffic stop, but says it traumatized five of their kids who waited in a squad car as the officer searched Skinner's van for more drugs to no avail.
You know, my kids, as we see the police driving down the street, taking them to daycare, they tense up. They get worried.
In 2018, a bipartisan group of Wisconsin legislators reformed state law aimed at preventing forfeitures from individuals unless they're convicted of a crime. But there are exceptions. Money or property referred to federal agencies like the DEA can be forfeited even if charges are never filed. And state or local law enforcement can keep proceeds from those forfeitures if a person is deported, flees the jurisdiction, or doesn't claim cash or property within 9 months. Dan Albin is the co-director of the National Initiative to End Forfeiture Abuse. He calls it policing for profit.
That, I think, is highly problematic when the federal government is encouraging state and local law enforcement to not comply with their very own state laws and instead simply participate in a federal program that allows them to sidestep or circumvent those protections.
At least half of any proceeds from state-level forfeitures must go to Wisconsin's school fund. But if a forfeiture goes federal, state and local law enforcement can keep all proceeds sent back by the U.S. Department of Justice following a conviction. In 2020, police in Wisconsin reported around $775,000 in cash and property forfeitures tied to convictions. That same year, the U.S. Department of Justice sent nearly $2 million in forfeited proceeds back to agencies in Wisconsin. Skinner suspects the state patrol referred his money to the DEA in order to get a second opinion after the district attorney didn't file criminal charges. In Brown County, the sheriff's office received around $117,000 from the feds in 2020 for seizures it made. Lieutenant Matt Ronk is the director of the Brown County Drug Task Force. He says seizing assets is an important part of fighting criminal organizations, and he says his team isn't disproportionately seizing money during investigations.
But I also have a real problem leaving drug proceeds, illicit gains, predatory funds that were taken off of innocent people, innocent victims, that either by force or by victimizing them with addiction.
As for Skinner, he's hired a lawyer at an estimated cost of $4,000 in hopes of getting his $9,600 back from the DEA. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the governor and lawmakers have approved new standards for PFAS chemicals, so-called forever chemicals, in Wisconsin water, and now the EPA has set long-awaited federal guidelines. We'll get the latest news from both fronts and what it all means for the water we rely on here in the state. And for a lot of people, the pandemic changed priorities in one way or another and maybe made us think about the things we spend our time on. We'll get advice to help figure out what we want to do and when we do it. Our guest talked to time management experts and a lot of real people about what they spend their time on, what they feel like they waste their time on, and what they feel would be a more valuable way to spend their time. Hoping you'll join in on that conversation as well. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time from 3 until 6.